Well, good morning, everyone. It's good everybody didn't have too much difficulty getting here through the slush and the snow and ice and whatever that there is out there. Depending on where you were at, I guess, and how much actually fell, I looked at the radar all over the areas this morning, and it didn't seem too bad. So I didn't hear from anybody squealing with joy that there was so much ice and snow they couldn't get out or anything. So that was good. Last time we finished up a subject, and I thought I'd move into another doctrine. I didn't have any more questions this go around, so I thought I'd move into another doctrine of the church. This one is actually the third doctrine of the church, or the second or third, I'm not sure which one it is, on Satan the devil. We have not covered that one of the 20 primary doctrines of the church. One of the things that comes up in discussion from time to time, of course, is the subject of Satan the devil. And today I'd like to take a look at it and to at least start probably one of two-part Bible study on him of the 20 fundamental beliefs of the church regarding Satan the devil. In the course of the study, we're going to look at some commonly asked questions about him. One of those questions is, why does God allow him to deceive human beings? Or will God destroy him in the end? Or why does God allow him to be released at the end of the millennium into a peaceful environment? There are a number of questions that people frequently have about him. So we'll get to some of those questions at the end, but I thought I'd cover the basic doctrine first, and then we'll go into some of the questions about him when we get to the end. Our basic doctrine of the church, and I'll quote it, it's a short paragraph. It says, we believe that Satan is a spirit being who is the adversary of God and the children of God. Satan has been given dominion over the world for a specific time. Satan is deceived or has deceived humanity into rejecting God and his law. Satan is ruled by deception with the aid of a host of demons who are rebellious angels, spirit beings who followed Satan in his rebellion. And that's basically the statement of belief that we have in our booklet on the fundamentals of belief, and it's stated in a number of other places as well. But there are five key elements in that statement that are backed up by many scriptures. I won't try to read through all of them and explain all of them, because there's probably way too many to read. A number of them state things in a similar way or don't contain an awful lot of different information from another scripture, so we'll cover the primary ones that give us the basic information, and I'll just do the key scriptures regarding them. Clearly we know Satan has made himself the enemy and the adversary of God, and certainly of God's people. Even the meanings of his name in both Hebrew and Greek have to do with the meaning of adversary, or one who opposes, or one who is against. And certainly he is against the work of God and all at every opportunity that he has to be so. His hatred for God's plan is probably only exceeded by his hatred for the potential sons and daughters who will enter his kingdom and ultimately be his, I don't know, what do you call him, supervisor, boss, that they'll be over him. And that's something he can't stand the idea of. His rebellion was based on the fact that I can do things better than God can. So I ought to be running things. And that's how he approached it, and that's why his rebellion formed in the way it did. And he's known and denounced in Scripture in a number of different ways, Revelation 20, Revelation 12. There are places where he's talked about a little bit. Revelation 12, in particular, verses 9 through 10, he's referred to as a deceiver and accuser of the brethren. And a lot of these scriptures you're familiar with, but so I won't read them all, but just to kind of remind us, that's, you know, where it says those things about him. He's a murderer, a liar, and the father of lying. We find that also in John 8, verse 44. All of us have at one time or another probably found that we have an opportunity in this life, and unless you've been living in a cave at the top of a mountain somewhere without any human contact, that we have an opponent in this life, and that sometimes things just seem to go inordinately wrong for some reason, and you can't figure out why. It's almost like almost everything gets turned against you from time to time, and you can't figure out why it's all gone so bad so quickly. And I sometimes think those are occasions where it's not just time and chance, but somebody is setting things up for you to make things pretty difficult. We certainly know of his activities with in the book of Job with a gentleman by the name of Job, and all that he went through because Satan said, you know, told God, you know, we can. The only reason that he's being so righteous is because you haven't let anything bad happen to him, God said, well, okay, he's in your hands, but you have to spare his life and things went inordinately bad very quickly for Job, seemingly overnight. Well, sometimes it may occur that way in our lives as well. If we take the opposite of God's plan to make spiritual sons who will ultimately rule the universe and judge angels under Jesus Christ, then you basically have Satan's plan, is to basically undo all that God is doing, if it's possible to do so, or to prove that God's way is not the only way of doing things, that he has ways of doing things that are better, and certainly stop God's plan and destroy potential sons of God, and that not to be ruled by anyone and to rebel and to rule God himself. Those are the things he'd like to do. And that basically summarizes his plan. If you're looking for, does Satan have a plan? Certainly. All you have to do is basically reverse anything that God says he's going to do, and you can pretty well count that's the direction Satan wants to go. You and I are right in his way or right in his path in that process of what he's doing. Let's go to Ephesians for a moment. I want to read three scriptures to you in a row here. Ephesians 6, beginning in verse 11, is one of them. Ephesians 6 and verse 11. It says, "Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil." We are to be close to God, to put on the armor that God provides for us, which is a spiritual form of armor. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. And indeed, we do have an adversary who runs those. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand, or to end up standing. It was a military expression. The men left standing at the end of a battle were basically the survivors, that you may, when it's all over with, you may end up standing, is the desire of every soldier and every Roman soldier at that time. Let's go to Second Corinthians. We also see a little bit about him and what he's doing. Second Corinthians chapter 2, let's see, in verse 11. 2 Corinthians chapter 2, in verse 11, lest Satan should take advantage of us, for we are not ignorant of his devices. And we certainly don't want all ourselves to be ignorant of the fact that he is out there, that he does intervene, sometimes a little less often than we might give him credit for, but he certainly is out there, and he certainly will do his best when, the toughest times come along. Sometimes he's, involved in them. Luke chapter 8 also describes it a little bit. Luke chapter 8 and verse 12. He says, those by the wayside, and he's talking, of course, about the parable of the spreading of the seed here, and he's saying the seed that goes by the wayside. Those by the wayside are the ones who hear. Then the devil comes and takes away the word out of their hearts, lest they should believe and be saved. He is there to try to disrupt those whom God is calling, whom God is revealing his plan and where he's where he plans to take them to. And oftentimes, right around the time someone is considering baptism, the trials and difficulties sometimes begin to mount. Satan, like all other beings and things within the creation, have certain limits which God has placed on them to allow them to operate. We find him and his desires, they're controlled by God. He doesn't allow Satan to have completely free rein and do just anything he wishes to do. And the book of Job, gives us a few brief insights into that as well. Let's go over to the book of Job for a moment, just read a few of the first opening verses here in the book of Job. Job chapter 1. If I can get there here. All right. Job chapter 1. Let's read verse 12 here in chapter 1. I don't think we need to read through the whole section. I think you're familiar with the story. And the Lord said unto Satan, Behold, all that he has is in your power. Only upon himself do not put forth your hand. So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord. And of course, guess what he's going to do? He's going to test, try, and tempt Job in any way that he can to try to get Job to curse God. Let's go over to chapter 2 and verse 6. And the Lord said unto Satan, Behold, he is in your hand, but save his life. Again, he released him again after going and making havoc out of Job's life. And then he comes back to personally attack his body, so to speak, to come back, okay. You know, we've taken away his children, we've destroyed his homes, destroyed his valuables, all that makes him a wealthy man. Satan's taken away, whoosh and whirlwind in one day. And then Job still hasn't cursed God. So God says, well, okay, if you want to touch him physically, okay, but you have to spare his life. And so Satan moves out to go get him again. And go after him again. We also see Job recorded for us kind of the accusatory attitude that Satan demonstrates toward human beings. He is not just an illusion. I think we see a very real picture of Satan and what he does here in Job. I won't try to read through this whole first chapter and second chapter that deal with this, but of course, the entire book of Job deals with a lot of it, but Satan's part in it initially doesn't work on the righteous man Job. However, there are some lessons along the way that God knows that Job will benefit from learning, and so he allows it. Satan, of course, is the god of this world, and he does what he wants to do. We also see that he's very real in terms of many of the discussions that the Bible holds. Yet the world holds him as a kind of a figment of somebody's imagination. That he's just kind of representative of evil in general, but that he really doesn't exist or he really isn't real. And of course, Satan would love for people to believe that he doesn't exist, because then he can wreak havoc and do his will, and nobody gives him credit for it. Nobody points to him, which means, as they point to him, they're certainly pointing away from God, and they're saying, okay, this also means there's probably a good side to things, that God is involved, or that God is, if Satan exists, that means God exists, doesn't it? Subconsciously, that's always there, or that's in the plan. And then we see him doing the same thing to Jesus Christ. In Matthew 4 and Luke 4, we see the temptation of Christ and him coming to do his best to tempt Christ. Of course, this is the next major step in God's plan after the creation here is to bring his son and the sacrifice forward to in order to be part of the process of saving mankind or salvation. And so he then comes immediately after Jesus Christ as a physical human being, in the New Testament, and we find in Matthew 4 and Luke 4. And he's there to tempt him and to destroy God's plan as best he can. So he's always going to be right on the scene whenever a major step in God's plan is about to take place. And he's certainly the God of this world, but his reign will come to an end at the end of, at the return of Jesus Christ, and he knows it. He knows that it's going to come to an end. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, we didn't read this, I think we read 2 Corinthians chapter 2, didn't we? Let's go to 2 Corinthians chapter 4, 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 4. Actually, we can look at verse 3 is kind of where it starts. It says, but even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing. There is a veil over the eyesight of many people in this world, whose minds the God of this age has blinded. He is the master of the veil, so to speak. He allows people to see up to a point in this world until God takes the veil away from them. And whose minds the God of this age has blinded, who do not believe, lest the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine unto them. They don't see because of this veil, because of what Satan has draped over this world, all part of the concept of what happened in the Garden of Eden in the taking of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. That began a process of human beings drifting away from God and being blinded to God and to God's existence and to his plan. Let's go over to Revelation 11. And Satan is always involved whenever one of those major points in God's plan comes up. Revelation 11, verse 15. Revelation 11, verse 15. Then the seventh angel sounded, and there were loud voices in heaven, saying, the kingdoms of this world have become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. This is the exchange of power. These kingdoms, who did they belong to before? Christ is assuming command. Who were they before? Well, they were Satan's. Satan had them delivered to him. Satan's time is limited. He knows he has up to this point where the seventh angel sounds. And then his kingdoms and his power and his authority are going to be taken away. He's not looking forward to that point, and he becomes angrier and angrier that his plans and the things he's doing are not succeeding the closer he gets to that point. And he knows he only has that amount of time up until the seventh trumpet in order to derail God's plan. And so far he has been unsuccessful, so you can imagine how angry he is and how much he wants to derail, and maybe has derailed some of the children of God or some of the potential children of God. At least maybe he's had some success there, he thinks. Maybe he has. I don't know. And so the angrier he gets at the potential sons of God, you know, if I can eliminate as many of them as possible, you know, I've done as much damage to God's plan as I possibly can. When Jesus Christ returns, he's going to be bound. Bound up, taken away for 1,000 years. And then he will realize that, you know, the major portion of his opportunities are gone and he isn't going to succeed. And Christ will reign on the earth for 1,000 years. John 12. Let's go back to John for a moment. John chapter 12 and verse 31. John chapter 12 and verse 31. It says, now is the judgment of this world. Now the ruler of this world will be cast out. That's when this happens, at the seventh trumpet. Jesus Christ came qualified to be the ruler of the world during the course of his physical lifetime, qualified to be King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and he will replace Satan at the seventh trumpet. Number of scriptures that lead us to that. Speaking of when the judgment of the world begins, as God's wrath begins at the end of the tribulation, just as the seventh trumpet is about to sound, that is the end of Satan's efforts. The end of Satan's efforts. Revelation 20. This is one that people read all the time. Revelation 20, verses 1 through 3. It says, then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having a key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. He laid hold on the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. And he cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal on him so that he should deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years were finished. But after these things, he must be released for a little season, for a little while. depending on which translation you have. And we'll see Satan removed from power, but not destroyed. Let's go over to Hebrews 2 and verse 14. Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 14. Sometimes it's good to go over these basic doctrines. I know we have a number of younger people in the church who maybe have never been through these, and they're good to hear, although I'm not sure how many are hearing it this morning. But anyway, Hebrews 2, verse 14. Inasmuch then as the children have partaken of flesh and blood, he himself likewise shared in the same, that through death he might destroy him who had the power of death, that is the devil. So is God going to destroy Satan? Interesting. We have never taught that God is going to destroy Satan, yet it says he's going to destroy Satan right here. We're going to take a look at this word destroyed a little bit later, because that's where the flaw is in the translation here. That's not a good translation of the word. Seems to say that God will. We'll look at it a little bit later. That's one of the verses I want to cover in some of the questions that follow. But let's continue with the summary of what we know about Satan. We also know that Satan was a created angel. Probably one of very high authority. We don't know exactly what all of the rankings are among the angels, or exactly, you know, what is the difference between an archangel and a cherub. I'm not 100% sure. The Bible describes both, but it doesn't say whether one is the other, or whether one can be the other, or whether one, you know, you can be a cherub but not an archangel, or you can be an archangel but not a cherub, or, you know, exactly how all of that interfaces. So we do know a number of things about Satan from the Old Testament that are recorded for us, Isaiah and Ezekiel. Let's go to Ezekiel first. Ezekiel chapter 28. I always remember it's Isaiah 14 because it's just half of Ezekiel 28 when it comes to remembering where the Bible talks about Satan. Or you can say, you can remember Isaiah 14 and say just double it in Ezekiel, and that's where you can go there, whichever way you prefer to do that. Ezekiel 28, verse 14. He says, thou art the anointed cherub that covers. So we know he is a cherub, and I have set you and you were upon the holy mountain of God. You walked up and down in the midst of the stones of fire, which we know are surrounding God's throne. You were perfect in all your ways from the day that you were created till iniquity was found in you. So Satan was a created being, and iniquity was eventually, or sin was found in him. By the multitude of your merchandise, and then it goes on and talks about some other things, and then it comes back and talks about him again, but we'll read on through verse 17 at least. By the multitude of your merchandise, they have filled the midst of you with violence, and you have sinned. Therefore, I will cast you as profane out of the mountain of God, and I will, again, this word destroy is not the best translation of the Hebrew word either. I would destroy you, a covering cherub, from the midst of the stones of fire. So he was one of the very covering cherubs close to God in the beginning. Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. You have corrupted your wisdom by reason of your brightness, or your glory, so to speak, or how important and how beautiful you were. I will cast you to the ground. I will lay you before kings that they may behold you. Going to be, and certainly those kings are probably referring to priests and kings, the children of God one day. We'll see him as he really is one of these days. We know there are other powerful angels also created. And the scriptures identify him being part of a unique circle of very powerful angels. Michael and Gabriel are described as being very powerful angels. We don't know if they're considered cherubs or they were cherubs or not. They aren't described that way in particular. But we know there's at least one. There are probably at least four cherubs that are the are what become the four wheels or the transportation system of God's throne. But who they are, I don't know that they're all named. And you know, we could assume that maybe Michael and Gabriel and Satan are three of them, but we don't know. The Bible doesn't give us the specifics. Lucifer, of course, his name. Let's go over to Isaiah 14, where we find that as well. Isaiah chapter 14. Isaiah chapter 14 and verse 12. It says, "How are you fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How are you cut down to the ground, which did weaken the nations? For you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven, and I will exalt my throne above the stars of God." Again, stars referring to angels, or over the star, the angels of God. "I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north." In other words, he wanted God's throne. He wanted to be over God. And he certainly did try to do that. He fell from this very high exalted position he had in heaven, near God's throne, and was fell to the earth like, what does it say? Like lightning, I guess, is the way it's referred to. As he fell to the earth, Christ refers to seeing him fall as lightning. Certainly he did. Lucifer, meaning actually bright star or morning star, is the meaning of his name in Hebrew. He was created perfect and blameless. However, he became vain in his own glory. Maybe he liked to look at himself in the mirror a lot. I don't know exactly what, you know, what it was that triggered all of that, but I guess he thought, you know, I'm perfect. I'm better than everybody else. I could be better than God. You know, I have a better way of doing things than he does. I mean, there's all kinds of thoughts that could have been part of why he took the road that he did to sin. His choice of sin and rebellion caused God to cast him from heaven and from his throne. Luke 10:18, I think, describes that, where Christ makes that statement. Let's go see that. Luke 10 and verse 18. Luke chapter 10 and verse 18. Long chapters here. Luke 10 and verse 18. "And he said unto them, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven." Christ speaking to his disciples. 2 Peter 2 verse 4 describes it as well. 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 4. You may not get time to follow me through all of these, but 2 Peter chapter 2 verse 4 says, "For if God did not spare the angels who sinned," so clearly some of the angels sinned, "but cast them down to hell and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment." There is coming a time they will be cast down. They will be put in chains, so to speak, probably spiritual chains of some kind. They won't be able to get out or do things. In his rebellion, he took one-third of the angels. It talks about him taking a third of the stars of heaven in Revelation chapter 12, and I'm just about out of time here. So maybe that's a good place to stop, and we'll try to pick it up next time and hope that I can finish it next time. But let me finish the paragraph here at least. We know that the Bible often refers to angels as stars. Revelation 12, verse 4, we can read that one, I guess, and then quit. I think that's where it refers to it, to angels as stars again. Revelation 12 and verse 4. "His tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven and drew them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth to devour her child as soon as it was born." Talking about Christ, of course, being born. He was prepared to try to destroy God's plan at any opportunity along the way that he had the opportunity to do so. The angels that he drew with him, the stars of heaven, also rebelled and are called demons, or at least are referred to as demons in the New Testament in a number of places. And that's what we've referred to them along the way as well. Any questions so far? I think I've kind of got as far as about I'm going to get this time. So I'll mark it as December 19th in Canton.